Washington a la selección china de personas que presentan al mundo la antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur de Nijir Jilamujian para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas, con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
They told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundacion Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
And up next on your internet wheel or your archive dial or wherever you're listening to this on, it's the February 9th, 2023 edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. This one is another flashback. It's been a tiring day for me, although it felt pretty good, actually. The Huff meeting and all went well, although it was tumultuous. And probably a report on that one on Sunday, as well as a report on the Union of the Homeless meeting that we had the day before. And also some bitter words from Brent Adams, I think, of some strong and important words, as well as the protests that happened at the Mountain Community Resource Center, which still has yet not produced a truly positive result in terms of a change of policy. We're still looking for that so they don't send people out into cold weather and wet weather, even if they're trying to shelter under an otherwise vacant awning at night, and punish them by denying them social services and so forth, as we hear they have done. So we'll be hearing some of that on Sunday, but on this show you're going to be hearing a flashback to March 16th, 2006. And you'll be hearing a brief interview with a vet of Berkeley's Rainbow Village back in the 80s. And this is actually, interestingly enough, on the in the wake of the destruction of the Here There encampment in Berkeley, which happened about a week ago. If you're listening to this on, I guess, February 9th, 2023. Also, we then move to the Downtown Commission and its initial swing at the homeless with the parking lot. I called it the parking lot panic law, but they call it the parking lot loitering and trespass law, I think, in its first. It's not the parking garage. It's actually the parking garage ordinance, not the parking lot ordinance. It became the parking lot ordinance later, several years later, when it was gradually expanded, sort of creeped like the camel's nose into the tent. And now it is, of course, illegal to be in a parking lot or garage city-run downtown without parking or retrieving a vehicle. And you have 15 minutes to do that, or you can walk directly through, but don't socialize, don't sit in your car. You can't just park your car and sit in it. That's an illegal action. Now, it doesn't mean the police are enforcing that, but that's what it says on the face of the ordinance. I think it's facially unconstitutional, but sadly, no one has actually challenged it in court. So let's get out there and challenge it, folks. It's a good idea. You're going to be hearing Bernard. And I don't know if that's his first name or his last name. It's a little unclear to me, but it's a lengthy interview with him. He's been a defense, or at the time in 2006, was a defense attorney who started as a prosecuting attorney in the 70s in the Santa Cruz County DA's office. And he and I have a long colloquy with a few call-ins I think are of interest. And then you're going to hear a snippet at the end of Uncle Dennis's show, Uncle Dennis Davey, who died several years ago, used to have a show that immediately followed my nighttime Thursday show, much beloved by his fans and by lots of others, too, if you judge by the size of the folks who came to his memorial. Over 100 people were there. I still wish we had the series of testimonials and memories that were recounted there. Dennis was also a mainstay for the station. He was a fighter against FCC tyranny and monopoly, corporate crap, and he played a lot of rock and roll. Good for him. Be advised that as you listen to this show, the numbers that are given out, and there aren't a lot of them, but some of them at the beginning of the show, and include the pages in color website, are no longer operational, as far as I know, other than, of course, the traditional Huff line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the 831-423-4833, or 423-HUFF. And you can, of course, if you have questions, comments, you want to make any reports about vehicles being ticketed or hassled or homeless people being with their tents being trashed because it looks like the police activity in the Sycamore Grove area, that is along Highway 9, as you head up to Felton, right outside the city limits of Santa Cruz, seems to be starting to happen. Do give me a call, and if you see anything of that kind, or if you're interested in other issues that concern civil rights in Santa Cruz, if even more broadly, do let me know. 423-4833, and we'll, I'll get back to you. We'll see what's up. And here it is, the March 16th, 2006, this show. A little edited because some parts of it were less than ideal, but you get the you'll get the impact of it if you listen to it.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, it's Bathroom Spears Broadsides, the March 16th, 2006 edition. Stay with me for special guest at 7 o'clock, Bernard Pregerson, local attorney at law. We will grill this shyster and see how he does. Actually, he seems to be at least an amenable enough fellow. Wants to talk about the drug court. We're going to talk with him about that. Until then, we're going to do updates on the Downtown Commission today, which met at 8:30 this morning, as well as some of the usual sterling and stunning reports from the street. Stay with me. Dear, tape problems. Yes, it's one of those tangles that sometimes happens with the 25-year-old tapes. That's actually Kristen Lems we're listening to. She's actually done pretty well up to now. A lot of stuff on equal rights for women and some cute songs of her own. I actually wrote to Kristen Lems after I got some of her stuff in the 80s because I was so impressed with her singing, although I haven't heard her doing much stuff recently. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. I'm Robert Norris, and this is Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Let me see if we can play a little more of this Lems, and then I'll be back with you, but we'll just have to see if it works. Oop, dead air. Sorry about that, folks. You're, as I mentioned before, tuned to 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. Also, you can go to pagesincolor.com in case you want to join the chat room. Chat room is up. And I have some good news for those of you who can't catch the show regularly or who have been unable to hear past shows. Our, of course, really good news is that the big transmitter is back up. Thank you, big transmitter. Thank you, techies. Thank you, God. Thank you, whoever. So actually, we're now audible in different places. At least that's my understanding, unless I'm wrong about that. Secondly, if you're a fan of this show is now being archived again. It actually was archived all the time, but the website domain was hidden. Now it's back again. So if you go to huffsantacruz.org, huffsantacruz.org, you can hear past shows again. They're not some of the most recent ones. They're all up there, but some of them haven't been indexed, so you can't quite see exactly what's on some of the most recent shows. I'll try to get to that as soon as possible, but you will be able to hear those old shows. And some of these interviews are going to be important because, frankly, this is one of the few places that you can actually get this kind of information. So, for instance, on Sunday, when I'll be having a show from 9:30 to 1, and I'll also be guest hosting the show before mine, 7:30 to 9:30, Thomas Levitt's show. He's had a family emergency and has to leave town. I'm going to be playing the complete tape of the Downtown Commission hearing on the 10-minute trespass law, which will be coming up starting at 7:30 going to 9:30. It was a two-hour hearing. I'm going to be doing some breaks and so forth. There'll be some musical intervals and interruptions for those who are grossed out by many, many hours of me talking endlessly or letting others talk about the subjects that I find fascinating and important, namely criminalization of poor people here in Santa Cruz and how we can fight it. I mean, I think it's a key issue, and actually I know a lot of people in free radio share my concern, but they also would like to see a balance in the broadcasting music here and there and so forth. I have not been noted for my musical taste or expertise. So, but anyway, we're going to be having some accessible broadcasting that I think is a public service because you can't get the Downtown Commission hearings are not broadcast on the air. The only way you can get them is to wait until next week when the secretary, or I should say the staff person of the Downtown Commission, Laura, will try to have tapes available. But I'm going to try to do her one better and play my rather makeshift, somewhat CD tape that I made earlier this morning in its entirety on Sunday. And I'm also going to play a few selections from it, actually the beginning of it, today as well. So that's going to be coming up. While I'm getting all this together, I'm going to play a little street interview for you from Berkeley. I went up to Berkeley and San Francisco Bay Area to pick up Street Spirit, which is the homeless newspaper put out by the American Friends Service Committee and available for homeless folks and other folks to sell and to read. If you want copies of this, give a call to Becky Johnson at 479-9291, 479-9291. No death threats, please. And you can also contact me in my multi-stickered car if you see it parked downtown or running around. Just leave a note on the car. I want Street Spirits and where you can be reached and so forth. And I'll try to get them to you so you can sell them and maybe make enough coffee and money for coffee so you can come in out of the rain for a little while. Because after all, when the 10-minute trespass law passes in the parking garages, you ain't going to get to go there, buddy. We don't want no stinking homeless people there. So, Street Spirit picked them up on midweek. I think it was last week. I think it was early last week, and early in the week. Actually, this week, I believe, or was it last week? I don't know when it was. But in any case, there's an interesting article in Street Spirit on the 10-minute trespass law, and you can also check out that article by Becky Johnson on indiebay.org. If it hasn't been censored, and I hope it hasn't been. They've been pretty reasonable recently about her, at least on homeless issues. Or you can go to thestreetspirit.org, www.thestreetspirit.org, and you can read the articles there. A lot of interesting stuff. We haven't had much on the Santa Cruz scene since 3 or 4 or 5 months ago, but thanks to Becky, there's an article in there on this very, very current issue, which you don't see covered at all locally, either in the mainstream media or actually on Indie Bay, except by me and her, frankly. Nobody seems interested. But there was a very heartening turnout today, which I'm going to be turning to shortly. Before I do, however, let's go to this.
Here in Berkeley, talking with a veteran of Rainbow Village, which happened in Berkeley in the mid-80s, I suppose. Is that right?
I can't remember exactly how long ago, but I think it was about 20 years ago, maybe slightly more.
And you were living in your vehicle?
Yeah, I didn't move in right at the very beginning, and I would say I was on the fringe of the Rainbow Village community, but I did...
How did it start? How did the Rainbow Village actually come to be?
Well, my understanding was a bunch of people living in their vehicles on Fifth Street here in Berkeley, and they were getting chased out of there by, the usual reasons. And the city, for some reason, maybe it was just the times, decided that rather just leaving them to fend for themselves, they'd move them down to the waterfront. It had just been what's now a very pretty park. It was hadn't been finished at that time. It was just landfill, large area landfill. So they let the people move into a corner of that. And there was one fellow there named Vince who was sort of the, if not the leader, at least one of the best spirits there, and he gave it the name Rainbow Village.
Now, how long did you actually spend there in terms of the number of nights your vehicle was parked in the village?
Well, I think I was there myself a little less than a year. I came in some weeks after it began.
And you were there for a year.
I think it was just about a year. I can't remember for sure, but it was finally broken up. Various state agencies, or I forget the name of it, the agency that was in charge of some coastal agency had been trying to get a shutdown for a long time.
What was their complaint?
Well, I think their
goddamn homeless people hanging out, or
no? I think their unspoken complaint was that two people had gotten shot down there by a resident of the village. At least he was convicted of that, and I believe sentenced to death.
So that they used the same strategy and began demolishing homes in the nearby area whenever there was a crime of violence up in the wealthier areas of town?
That's an excellent question. It took some of us several years to think of that question after that happened.
How many were you in the Rainbow Village?
Boy, again, I'm guessing, like I said before we started, I'm really not one of the best people to interview because I didn't spend too much time there when I lived there. But I would guess there was about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9, 10, maybe 20 vehicles parked down there, and maybe somewhere between 20 and 30, 40 people.
It lasted for about a year?
I think so, yeah.
And was it a successful experiment while it was going on? How did it...
In some ways, it was definitely successful. I mean, we were mostly a bunch of pretty broken-down people, but there was a real feeling of community there. I guess that's the first time I began to really even think about the notion of community. Just realizing when I pulled in at night, somebody knew I was coming home. Even if I had talked to the people about 2, 3, 4 times a week, not very long, still it was like living in a small town, I guess, a very, very strange small town.
How did the police treat you?
Well, the honest answer is I don't know. As far as I know, they treated us pretty decently. There was one fellow called Officer Dave that people seemed to like, and he was obviously a policeman with something special. He'd come down and see the guy. He felt friendly towards him. There was certainly no, at least when I was there, there may have been things I didn't hear about easily. But I think they treated people pretty decently there. Certainly when they were after the two deadheads who were just visiting were murdered, the police came around and were very, of course, they wanted to get as much information from everyone as possible, but they treated everybody very very nicely, very gently, I think.
Were the crimes ever solved?
Well, the person was arrested and convicted, so...
Was that the person who did the crime, in your opinion? Or?
You
didn't follow the case.
I don't have enough knowledge to really have an opinion. Certainly, he had a past that wouldn't make it seem impossible that he had done it.
And was there? You said there was kind of a community there. What other kind of form did the community take? Did you have? Any kind of community kitchen or any other kind of sharing of resources?
There was not a formal community kitchen. There was a guy who was very crippled and somehow managed to get a hold of a lot of cans from dumpsters that were cans from somewhere that the labels had been ripped off of, and he had a sheet of paper that he could go down and whatever number was embossed on the can, he could read what was inside the can, and he would fix up a stew and we would eat it, and there was people who would eat together, but there was no formal arrangements. We were very broken down people, but there was just the fact that there was two lines of vehicles sort of facing each other across an aisle. Geometrically it was set up for the people to feel like they were connected to each other. You always knew what your neighbor was doing, and your neighbor was always doing something strange and crazy. So you got to feel, a connection with people.
Did you make any friendships that continued past the dissolution of the village?
Don't think so. Certainly when I see those people, it feels good to see them, and I think they feel good to see me, but no, I didn't make any friendships that continued.
Now, what about the problem or the situation when other vehicles came down to join you? Was there a big influx of vehicles that wanted to do this? Did that happen much?
I don't know. The spaces that became available were controlled by the city of Berkeley, and there was a fellow, I can't remember his name or what his position was, but he later became city manager, and he was the one who basically would decide. I don't know how it was decided, what people would move in there originally. I assume just everyone who was on Fifth Street, but then later, in my case at least, I had to go in and say that I wanted to move there, and after a bit I was allowed to move there. And people coming afterwards, I don't know. There were some people that were towed away, I vaguely remember. You couldn't just anybody come, and wasn't like Woodstock.
It was about 10 or 20 vehicles and slightly more people.
Yeah.
Now, are you yourself still
currently living in a vehicle?
No.
When did you abandon that lifestyle? When did you grow out of it, or what happened?
Well, after they closed, after the city, I don't know who closed Rainbow Village exactly, but it got closed, and some of us went down and parked their vehicles in the parking lot of a shelter that was down in East Oakland then. And stayed there for a while, and finally I got an apartment, and
you've been there ever since.
No, I moved my bus in back of the apartment, and I rented that apartment for a year, and the whole time I lived in the apartment, I didn't sleep a single night in the apartment.
Really?
I slept out in my bus because I'm very sensitive to structural noise, and noise that comes like that from footfalls or neighbors' TV, so I was much happier sleeping in my bus. And as I mentioned to you before I began, of my 30 years of living in Berkeley, actually the place that I was most comfortable in and the healthiest physically was when I was living in my vehicle at Rainbow Village.
So when do you plan to go move back into your vehicle?
Maybe when there's another Rainbow Village, I would consider it.
Would you like to give your name for the record?
No, I'm sorry. I would prefer not to.
Can I call you by your first name?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Albert, and we'll pass this on to the community for historical purposes.
Okay, and I hope that other people lived at Rainbow Village and who spent a lot more time and got a lot more deeply involved there than I did and could tell much more interesting stories, we'll get in touch with you.
Thanks, Howard. And we're in Berkeley, and it's about 9 o'clock on March 7th, 2006.
Yeah, and sorry for the uneven quality of that recording and the uneven sound quality, but then again, that's what happens occasionally with my kind of recordings. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with more nonsense around the 10-minute trespass rule. that is on the fast track to City Council, thanks to Councilmember Ryan Coonerty and Mayor Cynthia Matthews. Stay tuned. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM. Phone number here to call in, 427-3772. What I'm going to play for you now is a bit of the tape I was able to procure of the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women's March 1st hearing a couple weeks ago. The segment of the hearing that deals with the issue of the 10-minute trespass law, the law that is being proposed by Matt Farrell, the police department, and backed by Ryan Coonerty and apparently Cynthia Matthews, though she hasn't made a public statement about this. Apparently at the downtown task force, she expressed concern about fast-tracking this law, which would radically change the status of people who are casually socializing in parking lots or walking through them or in parking garages. It would make it illegal to be in a parking lot or garage at all, at any time whatsoever, unless you're parking a vehicle or parking a bicycle or presumably using the restroom. That would be an amendment to it that they've decided, you know, it'll let you take a dump. If you are parking a vehicle or you're parking a bicycle, you have 10 minutes to get your ass out of there and get on with your business under the new Barisoni proposed law. That's Jeron Barisoni is our city attorney, of course. Here is some of the background of the law is, as I've mentioned in the past, that the law was brought up by City Council, was put on the fast track at the consent agenda of January 10th, revealed in an article in the Sentinel by Shanna McCord. That's the only time it's ever been discussed in the Sentinel or any other local media that I'm aware of other than Indy Bay or this station. And a number of us sent in all kinds of concerned and upset letters saying, wait a minute, this hasn't gone through the downtown commission, which is the usual process. So they pulled it from the agenda and they sent it to the downtown commission, which met at the end of January. At that meeting, the downtown commission, after hearing testimony that the law didn't have any statistical backup in terms of particular incidents of concern, it wasn't clear where it was coming from, they requested more information, it wasn't clear it was legal in terms of civil liberties issues, and they put it ahead to their next meeting. This didn't satisfy council members Coonerty and Matthews, who put it on the fast track and insisted the downtown commission hold a special meeting, which Julie Shattuck dutifully did. She's the chair of the downtown commission. 2 weeks before that meeting, which was held this morning, Thursday the 16th at 8:30, and there was a protest there. We'll be hearing a little bit about that in a bit. There was this Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women meeting where Sheila Coonerty, who is apparently an advocate for this law, and also the co-chair of the American Civil Liberties Union, sort of the similar position to Mike Rotkin, who favors anti-homeless laws in Santa Cruz, but is on the board of directors of the American Civil Liberties Union, or he was anyway. He may still be, according to Don Zimmerman, who is an ACLU guy who showed up at the downtown commission meeting this morning, and we chatted with him, or I did anyway, after the hearing. But the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women was being presented with this in hopes that they would say, yeah, this is a great law, put it through. And here's what happened. I'm going to play some of the discussion, and you'll get a sense of how the law is being packaged by Matt Farrell, who's the parking manager of the Public Works Department, and Sheila Coonerty, who is the chair of the Downtown Commission. Or she was the chair. The new chair is Julie Shattuck. She was the kind of the representative, but she is apparently co-chair of the American Civil Liberties Union in Santa Cruz, which shows you the depths to which that organization has fallen. Let's hear a little bit now of the Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women's discussion of 10 minutes and you are out.
The recommendation is to hear information regarding proposed ordinance for downtown garage loitering per request of downtown commission and take actions as necessary. And we have two Sheila Coonerty here and Matt Farrell. And they will speak to this.
Hit the mic.
Yep. It's on.
Is it?
Welcome.
Hi. This proposed ordinance was brought to the Downtown Commission last time we met, and we held off making any decision about it until we could get a little more information and consult with you, with the ACLU, with the city attorney. about it. So we come here tonight just to see if we can get a sense of what this commission might think about this ordinance, whether you have any questions or statements you want us to bring back to our meeting. Matt, do you want to speak about the ordinance itself? The ordinance came to us through Public Works. All that, Matt.
Matt Farrell, parking manager for the Public Works Department. This ordinance proposal was generated both as a result of conversations with police officers doing downtown enforcement in our parking lots and garages, as well as with our parking maintenance personnel who do maintenance in the garages both early in the morning starting at 5 o'clock and then some who work in the evening as late as 1:30. And we have a number of women who work in those early morning shifts and evening shifts, and they were complaining about interactions they had with some of the people who hang out in the garages, and that recently those interactions have gotten more confrontational, and the character of the people hanging out in the facilities has changed. They're much more aggressive and confrontational than has been their experience in the past. So they were asking for some language that defined what the proper use of parking lots and garages was, so it would be easier for them to address these people and try and get them to leave the facilities. And as part of that, the commission had asked us at their meeting in January to give them some sense at their next meeting of what the history of incidents and calls were at these facilities. So we asked Zach Friend, who's one of the analysts for the police department, to look at incident reports in the garages, the four garages we have downtown. And in 2005, we had 541 calls or incidents that Zach was able to identify. Now, he mentions that it's hard to always classify incidents because they come in and they're placed based on information given on the call, and it's not always the same information in the same location. So this is his best kind of screening of those incident calls. But what we had were 188 calls at the Cedar Church garage here at right next to the Cinema 9 movie theater, 242 calls at the Riverfront garage, and 87 calls at the Locust garage, the corner Cedar Locust, and 24 calls at the SoCal Front garage. The SoCal Front garage calls did not include calls to the garage sports bar because that's kind of its own separate use and has its own set of problems. And in terms of the categories of calls, 63 calls, or 12% of the total calls, were related to camping. 31 calls were related to disturbing the peace. And 47 calls were related to burglaries, mainly car burglaries. And 41 calls were related to suspicious persons or circumstances. And on the second page, we have a list of locations and then the predominance of those calls by location. So, for instance, at the Cedar Church garage, disturbing the peace was the primary crime type. Camping was the second. Vehicle burglaries were the third. And then suspicious person circumstances was the fourth category. At Locust Garage, disturbing the peace was again the primary call problem for or reason for calls. Burglary was second, camping was third, and drug activity was fourth. And at the Riverfront Garage, camping was first, burglaries were second, disturbing the peace was third, and assaults at this location were the fourth highest call in that particular location. Although they, in the total number of calls, they were small at that location.
And to interrupt, this is Matt Farrell talking from the Public Works Department to the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women on the Downtown Commission's proposed ordinance to be rushed to City Council at its next council meeting, making it criminal to be in a parking lot for more than 10 minutes, not allowing you there at all unless you're parking a vehicle or a bicycle. Farrell's quoting a lot of stats, talks about 540 or so, or is it 560, calls for service to a parking garage. Well, if you look at the stats, and they are available online, you can go to the city's website, go Google for City of Santa Cruz, check it out if you'd like. You'll find that when you go to advisory commissions, go to downtown commission, you'll be able to check this forward for yourself. Of those 540-odd calls, and you have about 140 of those calls are for criminal behavior, and this is over the period of a whole year, and this is over the period of over a spread of four parking lots, and this is considered, if you consider a total of 77,000 calls for service, actually 76,000 calls for service, according to the stat given by Deputy Chief Kevin Vogel today at the Downtown Commission. And I know Kevin Vogel is perhaps not the best source on a lot of this stuff. Kevin Vogel, of course, is famous for his I investigate myself, I check myself over, I okay myself, everything is fine with spying on peaceful political groups. Actually, I kind of like Kevin as a local guy. I've known him for years, but, you know, that's strange. The fact of the matter is that there's no crime wave in the parking lots or parking garages, and the slow, kind of tedious way these statistics are recited conceals the fact that there really is very little going on other than some concerns by parking lot workers that they're, you know, having to clean up a lot of shit and take some rude behavior from homeless people when they tell them to get lost on cold and wet days or, you know, when they're camping and trying to get in out of the rain. And some, you know, I mean, it's a kind of a nasty job. So that to make their job easier, this is a law that's designed to drive everybody out of the parking areas unless their parking vehicles are bicycles, which some people say, well, that's fine. Go use the parks or something. And the trouble is that we're removing the equivalent of 7 to 8 blocks of city space, because we're talking not just about parking garages, but about parking lots. And there's no alternate space opening up. And there's no real justification for this. I mean, if there was a series of murders going on, if there was serial rapes, if there was a series of assaults. But no, there's uncomfortable feeling from some merchants and some moms in the community. I'm not saying that's something you want to ignore entirely. Certainly not. I mean, it's all important we be comfortable downtown. But the idea that everybody should now be made uncomfortable under a police edict, or not a police edict, a city council law that requires the police to make it a crime. You can go to jail. You know, I mean, you'll get a fine. If you don't pay the fine, you'll go to jail for walking across a parking lot, for even for returning from a parking lot where you're parking your vehicle for more than 10 minutes. It seems to me a radical change in how we're dealing with that particular public space in Santa Cruz. And you don't get any indication of this, interestingly enough, either from Matt Farrell or, sadly enough, from the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women. You do hear them saying, and you'll hear them saying later, gosh, you know, what does this have to do with, you know, women? I mean, you know, are there any stats about women being assaulted and women having problems in parking lots? And, you know, we are sympathetic to that. But the real issue seems to be, how can we get past those civil libertarian types who somehow feel that everyone, including women, should be free to use parking lots 24 hours a day without the police telling them you're under arrest for lingering here, for loitering here, when there's no criminal activity happening. There was no such discussion either at the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, and not much discussion at the Downtown Commission, but we're going to be talking more about that as we move along. Here's more of this discussion from the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women, and Matt Farrell continues talking. He's, again, public parking manager of Public Works, and one of the main people behind this law.
Fourth highest call. And then I've included a map here that shows the location of these facilities in case commissioners weren't familiar with that. Sheila asked me to check with the police department and see if there's a way to break these calls down by gender. And talking with Zach on incident reports, it's my understanding that that isn't the case. What would have to happen is you would need to go back and actually look at the actual police reports that were taken from these incidents, not the actual incidents themselves. We would say that we do know that there have been historic issues with assaults in our garages and in our parking lots, and this is a concern for our department. And we know this is an issue that the commission and the downtown commission have been working around with the whole idea of the safe network and trying to make downtown a safer place for people. So I think that explains a little bit of the history of why we're bringing this forward and what information we were able to get for the commission.
Exercising my prerogative to interrupt. Again, there were no stats on assaults brought forward in terms of, let's say, against women or compared with, say, nearby bars and other problems. I mean, if you want to eliminate public spaces, then, of course, why don't you just close up all the area around the bars and you might cut back on assaults considerably on Friday and Saturday nights. And, you know, I mean, actually, I'm not so much of a drinker myself. Maybe that's a great idea. But the question is also, what other consequences does it have for people in public spaces? It would actually be they're considering a far greater consequence. They're considering closing these public spaces permanently to everyone except when they're specifically engaged in parking a bicycle or car or going to the bathroom, which to me is a massive criminalization effort. And it's not justified by any of the stats. We tried to get those stats today, and we actually had the benefit of hearing from the parking workers who gave a very poignant plea about how all the problems are going to happen. We're going to hear their testimony on Sunday when I come back for another version, for a second longer version of the show, in our next show. But in fact, they had no written statistics. They had no written record of particular problems they'd have. And to me, this is both slipshod, and it also indicates a kind of arrogance. It's kind of like Kevin Vogel's deciding, oh, you know, I don't have to appoint somebody to look over my shoulder and see if I did a good job in doing a peaceful snooping on peaceful political groups thing on New Year's Eve. I'll just appoint myself. And, of course, I'll get away with it because the city manager is, you know, arm in arm, hand in glove, and, you know, rolling in bed with the police department, and it's going to just be, everything is going to be fine around that issue. Ditto with the city attorney. And that seems to be a kind of arrogance, a kind of assumption that the police can do no wrong, and therefore let's give the police all the power to make choices that really, I mean, the citizenry is what needs to be alerted. If we're going to stop rapes and assaults and crimes, we want lots of eyes watching in the parking garages and elsewhere. The more people who are present, the less likely there is to be criminal behavior. Unless, of course, you're talking about riots or revolution, in which case we have to consider who the real criminals are, and that's another thing and not likely to happen, unfortunately, at least as far as revolution goes, in Santa Cruz. So here's a little more from this discussion. Then I'm going to turn to I'll conclude this Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women hearing tape on Sunday, and I'll probably be playing it early, like 7:30 in the morning, because, again, I'll be taking over Thomas Levitt's show. Thomas has expressed an interest in having this tape played, along with some other stuff he wants played. So I'll be picking it up then for those of you who will find this of interest. Again, if you don't find it of interest, you can pick up much of it on the Huff website, and I'm going to ask Thomas to try to log his own show onto the Huff website, too. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and it's the website where these shows you're listening to here are archived. It's at www.huffsantacruz.org. I remind you, if you want to call in, the number to call is 427-3772. If you want to talk off-air to me, I'll pick up a message and return it to you at another time at 423-HUFF, 423-4833.
Just to add to that, some of the there were people who came to our meeting who were concerned about civil rights issues in regards to this ordinance.
Sheila Coonerty.
So that's one of the reasons why we needed some time to address that. And there was also more concern about the parking lots than the garages in terms of limiting the amount of time people could spend in them. So these are all the kind of issues we're trying to tease out. In terms of the ACLU attorney, who will be actually at our meeting, but who spoke to us about it, he felt that with the garages, it was a fairly easy issue to see them as public space for a specific use. And he said if they put up, the city could put up gates if they wanted to, and people would go in and out only because they had cars, so that it's not so much an issue of public access, whereas the lots were somewhat more questionable. He hasn't spent enough time yet to have really fully gone through it all, but that gives you a general sense of the concerns we have. I personally have some concerns about it. I have a 14-year-old daughter who has been harassed walking through the garage, so, and I don't think I'm alone. But we don't have a good way to get those exact statistics, or at least we don't think we do.
Yeah, this is Sheila Coonerty, who was the chair of the Downtown Commission, still a commission member, taking the issue to the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women. Notice that she says other people's civil liberties concerns. Some people had civil liberties concerns, indicating that she apparently didn't. As the co-chair of the ACLU, she hasn't expressed any civil liberties concerns, really, at least not recently, not at this meeting and not at the current meeting this morning that happened at 8:30. Sheila, of course, is part of the Coonerty clan. You know, she's the sister to Neil Coonerty, who's the owner of the bookshop Santa Cruz, former mayor, who gave us the current sit-on-the-sidewalk, go-to-jail laws, as well as a series of laws restricting political discussion, panhandling, and performing downtown, laws called the Downtown Ordinances that went into power in 1994. And, of course, she's the aunt of Ryan Coonerty, who made a showing at today's Downtown Commission meeting, not the one you're hearing now, which is 2 weeks ago. But this is a sort of it looks to me like a merchant group, a definite merchant interest group that somehow feels it's okay to eliminate space, not just for homeless people, not just for residents, but for the entire community, including their customers, to make them, it's sort of like, you know, rush downtown, get out of your car in 10 minutes, come in, spend your money, and then leave. I mean, it's it's like they want to put people on the consumer belt. It's now she, of course, will put it differently. You hear her expressing concerns about her daughter and about, you know, vulnerable women. And, you know, that's a concern in any urban scene. The question, though, is the solution to eliminate everybody from the scene? Or is it, you know, maybe if there's particular problems, to police more heavily? I'm not generally in favor of more policing, but if there's particular problems in an area, it's certainly to make the community aware of it, neither through police or through other, you know, citizens aware, keeping an eye out for each other. That, I think, is much more of a deterrent than huge, vacant, empty spaces that people who are predators will choose to use, but other people who are law-abiding won't go into because they're told no going in, you know, or you can only be here for 10 minutes, you got to go to your car and then leave. So it's, to me, it's a pretty clear situation, obviously, to the people who cooked up this law. It's not, and they're fast-tracking it. So rather than play more of the downtown, I should say, of the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women now. I'm going to play more of that on Sunday morning, as I said before, probably around 7:30 when I'll be taking over Thomas Levitt's show. And for those of you who want to hear that and the entire Downtown Commission hearing, of which I'm going to play the beginning now, you should tune in then. And again, at 7 o'clock, I expect, that's about 12 minutes, Bernard Pregerson to be here, and we'll be able to talk with him about drug courts and the drug war in Santa Cruz from an attorney's perspective. So stay tuned.
Okay, it's about 8:10 on March 16th, 2006. We're in front of City Hall. Looks like a protest against a 10-minute trespass law. Looks like about 15 people here. We've got music from a safe performer. Becky Johnson's here with a video camera. Art and Revolution is perhaps got a representative here, or maybe they're just a guy, a Glenn, and Joe Schultz of goodness knows what, the food man, Jumbo Gumbo Joseph, is here, as well as human rights organizations, Bob Patton and me. But also we have a couple here that's headed for court. Your name, sir?
My name's Jake Estrella. Forgive me, I'm eating breakfast.
Sure, and you are?
Kathleen Estrella.
And you guys are married.
Yeah, we just got
married. Tried to advise you not to, but nonetheless. So you say you've twice been stopped by police and have two charges pending against you, is that right?
Yes, correct. For basically being affectionate with each other and minor minding their own business.
And so the actual charge has to do with what you were searched and they found. What kind of drugs did they run into? Or did they claim that they found?
Well, they claim they found methadone, but what really?
Methadone or methadrine?
Methadone.
Methadone.
But what really happened was we were on private property, backing out of a friend's house, and they came up out of nowhere because I guess he had a ticket or something. They yelled and said I wasn't him. I mean, I told him I wasn't him and showed him something, my name on it. It's not him. I look nothing like this guy. He has blonde hair and blue eyes. I have black hair and brown eyes. And they claimed that I look like him so just so they could search me and my wife and took us to jail. Okay, that happened the first time. The guy caught up in front of the judge in trial and lied. And
the officer?
Yeah, the officer lied.
What's his name? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
I don't remember his name.
No, but he lied in front of the judge. He lied right in front of the judge.
What did he lie about?
He said that the person that he was looking for, who was like 40 years old and I'm a lot younger, he said that the person he was looking for looked identical to me, and the person he was looking for had blonde hair and blue eyes and was like 20 years older than me.
Now, did your public defender present counter testimony that this wasn't true?
Or? Yes.
And what, but didn't fight it very well. The public defender didn't even really work
the public
hard.
Defender was trash. He was just like working for the judge, it almost seemed. I don't know. But
what's his name?
Alan Cave. He didn't do a very good job for us.
So where is this first case? At what point? Is a jury trial coming up? Or?
No, now I have to take the sentence. I have no choice, or they're going to probably make it worse.
Yeah.
It's like I'm helpless. I can't do a damn thing.
They gave him two misdemeanors instead of two felony deals, so he's going to take the Prop 36 and take the two misdemeanors. We're going right now. That's what we're going to court for.
The other event, you apparently were driving together and you were hugging. What happened?
I was hugging him just like this, and there was undercover sheriffs that were following us, I guess, for a long time, and they said that I looked like another girl that they had a warrant for, so that's why they pulled us over. And then as soon as they like rushed the car, you know, and I showed them that it wasn't me, but then they took him out and started testing him, and like, I don't know, it just seemed like that should have been it, you know what I mean? Like, if they saw that it wasn't me, that it wasn't her, or
they continued to search the car and harass us, and they took me to jail, and it's just such crap.
Yeah, and it's really...
And we're leaving this town because we're going up to San Francisco because we're so sick of the police brutality and harassment in this town. It's never ending.
Yeah.
They don't even need a warrant, and they just barge in and do whatever they want here. We're sick of it.
Now, in your first case, it was the Santa Cruz police. The second, it was the deputies?
It was the sheriffs both times, actually.
Both times it was the sheriffs.
Yeah.
Santa Cruz sheriffs,
It's actually, Santa Cruz County sheriffs.
Right.
Every time.
But we've had run-ins with all the cops.
They're constantly, like, because we live in our car, like, they're constantly, like, waking us up, you know what
constantly
I mean? And, like,
harassing
us.
They scare the hell out of us. We're newlyweds, and we don't break any laws, but you know what? We walk down the street, and we're scared to death to fucking walk through this town now. We're only here because we're going to court, and we're splitting right back to San Francisco.
What we do now. We just come down for court, and I come down for my Alto classes, and then we just go back up to San Francisco.
We feel a lot safer up there. We're not subject to the police brutality that we are here. It's gotten out of hand here.
Both times they claimed to have found methadone or different things at different
points? No, the second time they didn't find a dang thing.
They didn't find anything.
They didn't find anything.
Charged with anything the second time?
I was charged anyway with under influence, and they didn't even know that. I passed all the tests, but the guy knew me from before, from a prior arrest like a year ago.
But you pled guilty to under the influence?
No, not yet.
I haven't even gone to court for that yet.
Previous, you charged, you pled guilty to two misdemeanors of possession of methadone?
Yeah, we're left with no choice. We tried to fight it due to a legal search and seizure and unprobable cause to stop us in the first place, but they won't.
Remember the name of the judge?
I tried to plead. Yeah. I tried to plead guilty first, I mean, just to get out of jail, and my lawyer said, no, I won't let you plead guilty on this. It's totally a bad stop.
How long were you held in jail?
For like 5 days. And then she had to bail me out.
I was a bail.
Bailed him out. Because we were newlyweds, you know what I mean? I want to be with my husband when we just got married.
What was the bail?
It was $10,000, but I paid $1,000. You know what I mean? So yeah, that's all our money too. So
yeah,
now we don't even have a way to.
Yeah, now we have to panhandle for gas.
Do you sleep outside or inside?
In a car.
Yeah.
So,
we even had money for rent and stuff, but all that's gone.
Yeah.
Due to this, now we're on the streets. We did have a place, and we had.
But
what we needed.
Had to pay everything.
We were going to go to Arizona too and start a new life down there, but now we paid everything to this. They not only did they rob us of our life, but they robbed us of our money.
We've been talking with
Jake Estrella and
Kathleen Estrella.
Thank you very much. My apologies on behalf of the community of Santa Cruz. However, there's no excuse for police misconduct of that kind if it's as you've described it.
Yeah, it is. It's worse.
Yeah,
we're scared of this place. We can't wait to get out of here again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the audience is assembling. It's about 8:30. We've got Deputy Chief Vogel and another police officer, Sergeant Flippo. Got the Lishers, President Merchant Representation. City Council Member Ryan Coonerty is here. A number of homeless folks. There's Glenn Ravenold over the hill from the San Jose Perch. Human Rights Organization's John Teelking. Singer from SAFE, Valerie Christie, is in the back. And Becky Johnson is videoing the affair. Looks like an ACLU man is in the front row, and human rights organization activist Bob Patton is also in the front row, and Matt Farrell is chatting with the commission members. There's a display up on the board here, I should say on the screen, where the city council sometimes makes, and members of the public have the right to make presentations, which apparently Matt Farrell is going to make some remarks and refer to the screen. Sherry Connable is here. Hey, Jerry. Didn't look too happy in the morning. And sorry about the time, Sherry. Yeah, the meeting is about to begin.
Now, unfortunately, this tape is a tape that's done sort of, it's not taken directly off the amplification system, which actually the V-man has given me some good advice around this, and I hope I can get better in my recording, but it's not the best quality. There'll be a better quality tape out next week, which I'll be getting directly from the city, but I feel this is an important enough issue to press on with it because there is a real-time crunch here happening. On Tuesday morning, next Tuesday, 5 days hence or so, the Downtown Association, which is the Merchant Association, will be meeting across from the Coffee Roasting Company on the second floor of that building right next to Starbucks, for those who want to go. It's a public meeting. It's at 8:30 in the morning, another one of those horrible 8:30 meetings. Some of us from HUF, Homeless United, Friendship and Freedom, and the Human Rights Organization will be attending. Looks like the merchants are lining up behind this stupid law, which kind of shows you, well, what really shows you what's happening is the fact that the main crime they're concerned about is camping. They want to drive homeless people out of these parking structures without providing any alternate place, without considering the consequences of upsurges of pneumonia, lack of shelter, the increased impacts of assaults on homeless people in public places if they can't sleep safely in some kind of grouping together, which they do in some of these parking garages. Anyway, Tuesday, that's happening at 8:30 in the morning. Then on Thursday, the Downtown Commission will hold another meeting. It's extraordinary. They're having one meeting after another in this quick fashion. And the reason they're doing it is simply to placate right-wing members of City Council, Matthews and Coonerty. I'm talking about Ryan Coonerty now, who are putting this on the fast track, even though it's obviously not a particularly good solution to, I mean, it's a rather unusual solution and certainly not a Santa Cruzan solution to the whole situation in the downtown parking lots and garages. So let's hear a little of this as I welcome my next guest and sort of lock him in. Now that he's seen where we are, of course, he'll have to be killed, but we'll try to keep this undercover. Here's some more of the tape from the Downtown Commission of this morning at 8:30. And again, they'll be meeting a week from today also at 8:30 in the morning, also at City Hall. And then 5 days after that, City Council will try to ram through the first version of this law. So there isn't much time for people to oppose this law, and I encourage people to start looking at it very closely. It's covered on IndyBay.org. If you want to go there, you can check out IndyBay.org. And you can also go directly, if you want, to the Downtown Commission, the Santa Cruz City Council's advisory body, on the Santa Cruz City website. Just Google for Santa Cruz City Downtown Commission. You'll get to their website. Now we're going to play a little bit more of the Downtown Commission, and as we and then we'll roll directly into our 7 o'clock segment with Bernard Pregerson. Stay tuned. You're tuned to Free Radio 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Actually hasn't started yet. This is a preliminary gavel, so it's going to start right now. Actually, I think we'll just go directly into our interview. And you'll be able to hear more of this, as I said, on Sunday morning, 7:30 in the morning. Set your clocks. We are an early bird group here. Okay, well, Bernard, there's your mic. Yeah, just kind of belly up to it or pull it over and put it about an inch from your mouth. That's the deal here. It's We encourage a romantic relationship with the microphone.
Right.
Now, Bernard, you are a defense attorney. What kind of an attorney are you?
Criminal defense right now. Most of my work is with one of this county's two alternate public defender offices. And most of my work since 1979 has been as a court-appointed alternate public defender.
Since
79.
So you've been around. You look pretty youthful for a guy who's around. What are you? You came 5 years old. You became a defense attorney, or
actually, I worked in the district attorney's office for 2 years when I came down in 1975.
Wow. So you were around when the police were beating up the homeless people with Code Blue.
Actually, I was.
Did you get involved in any of that action as either as a district attorney? I guess you were been gone from the DA's. Or were you a defense counsel for any of these police officers?
I wasn't, but someone I was in association with defended one of the officers.
Because I know they got off, and they were, you know, I guess Chief Peeney was sort of retired out the back door, the police chief. Code Blue, for those who don't know, is the phrase used by police officers to say, let's go beat up homeless people, and then they would go beat up homeless people. And six officers were eventually tried, but none of them was convicted that I remember. Do you have a different recollection of that?
I don't actually remember the outcome. And separate from their criminal case, I don't remember what happened to them regarding the disciplinary procedure.
I think they were let go, suspended or fired, or they moved. I don't know if they aren't working with other police departments as often as the case.
It could be. That's always, that happens sometimes.
But now you are a defense attorney that's correct, you're a defense attorney now?
Right, primarily, almost exclusively in adult drug court. And not just drug court. I mean the court that deals with people arrested for most drug offenses. Some are not, though, like possession of less than an ounce of marijuana.
So this is, of course, an issue that I've followed closely and passionately on this station, both in terms of medical marijuana trying to open up clubs, in terms of the new tax and regulate initiative that's being circulated around the county. You may have seen it, or that's actually a city initiative, to try to emulate what Oakland is doing with Proposition Z, which is to say we encourage the state to decriminalize, we ask the local police department to make it the lowest priority. To me, in a certain sense, kind of a weak-kneed deal, but they are trying to set up a commission to make sure that the police give some kind of stats to indicate that they are making it the lowest priority. Let me just begin with the broad question. In terms of looking at the war against marijuana users, which has gone on year after year and seems to continue to be mounting, at least nationally, 720,000 arrests last year, according to the National Organization for the Reform of the Marijuana Laws. And even here in Santa Cruz, I find, you know, we have repeated bizarre cases of the great liberal Bob Lee going after people growing medical marijuana, whether it's the fellow who had the clinic up in Felton. He was taken to task earlier this year and pursued vigorously. Then there's another homeless man at the same problem. What's happening with the drug war over the years that you've seen here in Santa Cruz, particularly against marijuana? What's happening with that?
Well, the enforcement by law enforcement and then subsequent prosecutions, if they even happen, is a lot less. Way a lot less.
It's dropped since 1975, you're saying, even though in 70...
It's dropped. You know, Mark Tracy, when he was the sheriff, and most of the... It's very low for small quantities for people who have those in their possession for personal use. Sometimes the officers just dump them. If it's less than an ounce and they're given a citation, the maximum fine's $100. That's for less than an ounce of marijuana. Cultivation is different, but then again, it depends if people have marijuana cards or not.
Or letters from their doctor, or even oral recommendations, all of which are the basis under Proposition 215 for being able to legitimately use medical marijuana. I mean, I think this whole thing is a major hoax, the whole marijuana drug war, and I find it unfortunate that we have to start playing little games with medical marijuana distinctions and can't move on to simply recognizing that where any drug can be abused, and many drugs are abused, but that the process of criminalizing people for doing this is an abuse in and of itself. Is that viewpoint shared by people and attorneys you know locally much, or is there a concern that, you know, marijuana destroys your brain cells and should
be criminal? You're talking about marijuana, or are you...
I'm starting with marijuana, but
okay, let's keep it to marijuana.
Well, let's start with marijuana.
Okay, so... Yeah. I'm going to keep it to marijuana, mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you that personally and as an attorney,
Not at this time,
but I'll just leave that one alone. I don't see marijuana cases in the court I'm at. The prosecution of cases for small amounts of marijuana happens in Department 1 and Department 2. And what I did to get ready for this show is I pulled all the criminal calendars in all the courts for last week, Monday through Friday, and I looked at every drug case that was in court for whatever reason. Some of them might have been there for the first court appearance. Some of them might have been there for sentencing. Some of them might have been there for failure to pay fine. Some of them might have been there for failure to show up for the first court date. And I can tell you that last week there was 22 cases in court for whatever reason for possession of less than an ounce of marijuana.
Out of a total of how many drug cases?
You know, I didn't total them all up, but I could...
Give me an estimate, bro.
Well, I can tell you right now, if you consider alcohol a drug, are we going to include that or not? Either way is okay with me.
You know, the problem with alcohol is use of alcohol is not illegal, but use of all other drugs is illegal. I guess you can, you know.
No, that's a good point.
You know,
and so the only alcohol ones I picked up were drunk in public.
Which is a different phenomenon.
DUI, driving under the influence, or driving under the influence with injury. So you want to set those aside?
Yeah, set those aside.
Okay.
In terms of other drugs.
Fine. So let's look at the other drug cases, and we're looking at the... marijuana cases, possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, I told you is 22. Mm-hmm. Possession of more than an ounce of marijuana was 5. Mm-hmm. Possession of concentrated marijuana,
hashish.
Probably meaning hashish, was 1. So,
how about other drugs, other than alcohol?
Okay, let's go up the line here. So, the next kind of drug cases are misdemeanors, which are possession of a hypodermic needle.
But marijuana is a misdemeanor as well.
Unless it's possession for sale, cultivation.
Felony, right. I'm saying it's not an infraction, that's for sure, right? These are all misdemeanors or felonies.
You know, I'm not 100% sure that marijuana cannot be treated as an infraction the first time around.
You can get a ticket for it, but then you can get a ticket for misdemeanors too. You know what I mean?
This is true.
You know,
so let's just assume that it's a misdemeanor.
Could be wrong, but that's my understanding.
Yeah, it's no more than the $100 fine. Mm-hmm.
But you then have all kinds of other criminal consequences like driver's license loss, student loan problems.
No.
No? Really?
No. Definitely not.
Really?
Really.
And so, for example, there's no immigration problem if you're an illegal immigrant?
Not for misdemeanor, no.
Really interesting, because
we're talking about less than an ounce of marijuana.
I know.
It's
if we're talking about 3 pounds, I wouldn't
very
care.
Lightly, you know? Very lightly. Very lightly. It's just the reality of, you know, the way it is.
I keep thinking that, you know, that there is an effect on driver's licenses. You can lose your driver's license for a period, particularly if you're
driving under the influence of marijuana, you can.
No, not even if you're not driving. But maybe you've seen that this is not the case. I mean, I certainly will, you know, I'll yield to your experience if you've had this recent experience in court that you've seen that that's not the case.
Yeah, not the case. I think if you're driving under the influence, obviously you got a problem.
Right. But,
and if you're driving... Perhaps, although I haven't had one of these cases where you are a driver.
Uh-huh. Well, all right, so again, the total of cases...
In possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, but not under the influence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you have a problem with your license.
So we got 22 cases of possession, 5 cases of
less than an ounce.
Less than an ounce,
yeah.
5 of more, then maybe with intent to sell. But just give me the broader figure of how many other drug cases are in the courts, excluding alcohol and excluding marijuana, because I want to get a general sense. And you know, I appreciate your having pulled these cases off
for
calendar,
sure.
By the way.
Well, the 5 is possession of more than an ounce of marijuana.
Okay.
Not possession for sale.
Okay.
And not sale. And then there's that one other one with hashish. There's 7 cases of possession for sale of marijuana.
Okay.
But that's not the problem in this community, marijuana, except for the people that are large growers for profit. Mm-hmm. People who have a small amount of plants with a letter from a doctor, marijuana card, with a medical problem, are not going to be successfully prosecuted or be prosecuted in a way with significant consequences.
Possess a joint, lose your license. I'm looking
at
some
check
stuff.
Into that if you want. But if
right.
you want to know about the more serious drug problems in this community, I'm glad to forge ahead.
California, it's sunsetted. So your point is, it sunsetted in 1999, apparently, according to this. So there was a law that you possess a joint, lose your license, which sunsetted. So, but again, the broad number of cases, I'm trying to get a sense of what percentage of marijuana, of all kinds, of all the drug cases in the last week.
I'll give you the numbers last week of the other drug cases.
Go for it.
The biggest one is methamphetamine.
Okay.
127 cases.
Out of compare with about 30 or 35 total marijuana sales, possession, and so forth.
No, let's go 30 of including possession.
Including everything. All the marijuana.
Let's just say 30.
30 cases. So we've got 127 methamphetamine. How about heroin?
Heroin, coke, crack, or oxycodone, 86.
Okay. So
then we have misdemeanor under the influence, which is a case where you're showing symptoms of being under the influence.
But not necessarily driving, right?
Pardon?
Not necessarily driving.
We're oh, definitely about, not.
Right,
no, this
right.
is out of a car.
Right, okay.
You get arrested. They take a urine sample. They send it off to a lab.
Gotcha.
And it comes back. And you're going to get convicted if it's positive, which most are. And these are the drugs they're mostly positive for, methamphetamine or opiates.
So this
or cocaine.
The figures on cocaine and the other harder drugs are for both possession and under the influence, or just for possession or possession with intent to sell? And
well, some people are, like, for instance, hypothetical. I'm driving, and you're a passenger, and there's another passenger in our car. And I'm legally pulled over and stopped. Maybe I'm even pulled over for drunk driving and arrested. And the officer is going to ID everyone in the car, or at least look in the car if he sees a person in the back seat who's nodding out or looks like they're under the influence. The person's going to be out of the car, ID'd,
right.
and look for symptoms of being under the influence,
uh-huh.
and arrested if they show enough of them.
So my question is this. Looking at the court calendars as you did, what percentage of all court cases are drug cases? And I don't want a real, I don't know this to require from you a very specific, accurate.
I don't know the answer. Cause
we're talking 10%, 100%, 5%.
You know, I would have, if I would have at the same time counted up all the non-drug cases, I could answer your question.
Maybe, you know, and I don't want to put you back into this process again, but if you notice that in the future, and maybe we can kind of check in with you, because my concern has been that there is a disproportionate concern with war on people who use drugs, not even abuse drugs, but use drugs. As they aren't engaging in any other criminal behavior other than possession, maybe with intent to sell, maybe with maybe under the influence, but nothing that would, say, jeopardize other people around them. This takes up a huge amount of court time, and I'm kind of curious to know, am I accurate in this perception?
I think you're accurate about the same thing. I think you and I are in agreement about a couple things, which is people that are under the influence of or in possession of heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, OxyContin without a prescription are targeted by law enforcement and the courts.
And then the question, by Bob Lee's DA department, correct?
Well, the court, the DA is the one who brings the charges.
The DA could decline to prosecute and it would stop
the cops.
Yeah, but they don't. I'll tell you why they don't.
What the thinking is. The thinking is, well, first of all, let me just tell you this. The first time you get a possession, even felony possession of a heavy drug, if you have no drug history, no felony history, you're going to get drug diversion.
This is pre-Proposition 36?
It's been in effect for way before Prop 36, gotcha. It still is.
Prop 36 was a law in 2000, for those who don't know, which in essence required nonviolent offenders to get a special diversion program.
Yeah, but first you get a chance at the first diversion program.
Right, but there was a prior diversion program prior to 2000, which was in effect.
It's still in effect.
And it's still in effect.
Yeah. So if, I have my first drug offense and I don't have any prior felonies, irregardless of Prop 36, 99% of the time I'm going to get drug diversion, which means within 6 months I take 10 drug classes once a week and I pay a $100 fine.
Mm-hmm. And you pay for the classes.
Yeah, except that people, it's on a sliding scale.
Right.
And in a few cases, people without money can do volunteer work instead of paying for the full course.
You also have to, of course, deal with your landlord when they smashed in your door to get the drugs. And you may have to rent a new place, for example.
That doesn't happen hardly ever. But really? I understand where you're coming from. You're trying to make law enforcement look worse actually than they are.
No, I don't want to do that. I want an accurate. Well,
they don't smash into doors hardly ever, especially if someone's home. You have a chance to come to the door, but many people are in the bathroom flushing drugs down. Mm-hmm. Other people don't. But if you're not home and they have a search warrant, they are going to come in and they are going to search your house. And depending on who the officers are, it's going to be from stem to stern, and it is going to be a mess when you get home, no doubt about it.
Don't you think it's kind of outrageous that the sanctity of your home can be so disturbed in that way?
I think there's definitely, without a doubt, a way to search a home, especially a kid's room, without cutting open stuffed animals looking for drugs.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about setting foot in someone's house under these circumstances when your only pretext is that someone is using an illegal substance. That's my concern.
So you're saying should drugs be legalized so that that would throw out the warrant, the whole possibility of searches?
I'm saying it is outrageous that that people in their homes have to face the fear that armed individuals will crash into their homes with or without a warrant, with or without knocking on the door, simply because they are using a substance that has no impact on anybody else. That's my claim. I mean, I'm just saying this as person to person to you.
Yeah, I understand.
You know. And you might disagree with me. I think, no, it's very important for preserving the moral character.
First of all, they can't smash into your house without a warrant. Second of all, if they have a warrant,
they can. With an informant, they can. You know, I mean, it's true. I mean, it can be challenged in court. And you know, as a defense attorney, you no doubt have gone to suppression hearings and tried to do that successfully, hopefully.
Definitely.
Right.
Definitely.
But there's a
big question that we haven't hit on, which is, should drugs that are used for personal use only, not sold to minors, not sold through the community, widespread where people who aren't even users are making tens of thousands of dollars. Let's just set those few cases aside. Everyone else who's using drugs recreationally, whether it's a serious drug or something innocuous like marijuana, should they even have to be charged with crime? Shouldn't it just be all legal?
Right. Well, I mean, you know my answer to that.
Yeah.
My question, though, is how big a business is this for defense attorneys, prosecutors, police, and judges? How much money are they making off this, frankly, racket that's going on? In other words, to me, this is not only a constitutional violation of everybody else's rights, but it employs a whole bunch of people, not to mention the drug testers and, you know, the people who manufacture the kits.
Definitely does. Right. And then the question is, well, why?
Well, you know, why do we have feudalism? Why do we have, you know, burkas? Why do we have crazy shit all over the place? We have a call. Maybe we should let the caller in on this.
Well, let me just...
hang on, caller.
Don't
go away.
Hold a second. And, you know, if the caller wants to ask about this, great.
Let me bring him online.
Bring him online.
Hi there. You're online with Bernard Pregerson and Robert here. Hi, are you there?
Robert, yes. Going to take calls?
Yes, we are taking calls. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Okay.
I can hear you.
Okay.
It's Madison. How are you doing?
Hey, Madison. Good.
Well, I'm a victim of meth crime, you know?
Okay.
And I wanted to explain how it affects a business or people, individuals.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In relation to my business, I had, like, it's been slow, so I had to wait, like, 18 months to buy tires, right? So I get out $500 of brand-new freaking tires so I can drive over Highway 17. And this meth head goes up and down the block, knifes them all. You know, and nobody replaced my tires. I lost a day of work.
Hold it, Madison. Madison, let me understand this. He slashed your tires? Or what?
Yeah, and they did a bunch of them all over town, $20,000.
Well, we're not talking about meth. We're talking about somebody who irresponsibly slashed your tires, whether he might have been mad for six other reasons, but he probably was because of...
He was on meth.
Right, right. But, I mean, are you saying that...
Who's going to replace that? And then I had my mirror broken off by another meth head.
Right, but
that was $500 in a day of work.
Right. Well, are you saying that any use of this drug should be basis for criminal prosecution? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying that the damage doesn't just where you were saying, oh, well, one guy's using it doesn't affect anybody, but
that's right.
I mean, and then I had
it does affect
people. Then I had another bunch of kids shoot out windows. And yep. That took, you know, that was added up to be $3,000, and it was a pouring rainy day, and we had a $300,000 deal on the line in the middle of a recession that employed 30 families, and we're not supposed to get pissed off?
Okay, have you ever had anybody commit any crimes who weren't on meth? Maybe they're on oxygen or milk or something else.
I had two peeping toms and seven people trying to come over my fence.
Right.
I mean, and I had another drunk rip up a $15,000 arbor. This is in like an 8-month period.
Right. Well,
and this thatch goes on like I have no reason to fit.
I got you,
and
Madison.
And that doesn't
include
12 windows that were broken in front of my house and the 10 assaults and 90 jillion drug deals.
Madison,
go do it at your house.
Right.
You don't want it on Maple.
Right.
We're over.
Right. Thank you.
We're
I mean,
over the top with it. I don't care what side of the fence you are, fed or local.
I understand.
Don't come
and,
here.
And if I lived in a neighborhood where people were dealing heroin in front of my house, you might see me taking a different stance.
I have a house at the moment.
So
maybe to get them to get somebody.
But Madison, hold up. I'm going to ask Bernard to give some thoughts on what you've just said.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm going to hang up.
All righty. Thanks
okay.
a lot. Go ahead, Bernard.
Well, she touched on a point, actually, I was waiting to make, which is this. Persons that use the heavy drugs, mm-hmm. it affects more than just themselves.
That's just people who abuse alcohol affect more than themselves.
Abuse it. Well, not everyone who drinks home alone and, you know, gets drunk, they may do no damage to no one other than their own liver.
Everyone who uses methadrine will do damage to other people necessarily.
Not necessarily, but one of the difficulties with meth is for some people it makes them more aggressive than normal, and they do the kind of things, apparently, that she's been a victim of.
But aggression in our society, properly channeled, is American as apple pie.
And but that's not properly channeled from what heard from her.
But one of the reasons for that might be the fact that it's criminalized. I mean, if you had people training in meth sessions and so forth and how to use methadrine, that's kind of crazy. But, you know, I mean, I can envisage as a science fiction fan other scenarios that might be used. What I do see is massive criminalization resulting in, and this is my question to you, I'm trying to find out locally, and you've done some
good... Let me just finish making this point.
Sure, go ahead.
And then I'm curious where you come down on this. You're a parent, and you're abusing drugs, and you're spending part of the family's money to support your habit, which is taking money from the welfare of your children. Mm-hmm. Is that a drug that should be, and whose use should be legalized in those circumstances? Or is it something where someone, whether it's the courts or someone outside of the person who has an out-of-control drug habit, gets some type of assistance because his or her use is affecting someone else.
I mean, substitute gambling for drugs or substitute any other kind of addiction for drugs, and the question becomes, should that be illegal? Is that the best way to do it, or do you want to apply some other community help or medicalization model to address the issue?
If we had the money for it and medical treatment, more drug treatment, that'd be great. But actually, that's what the version in Prop 36 more significantly try and address. People who successfully finish Prop 36 get their cases dismissed.
But there are plenty of people whose cases are not dismissed who are languishing in the Santa Cruz jail, as far as I know. And what I want to find out from you is how many people that is. How many people are actually in custody in Santa Cruz in the drug war, the local drug war? Because, you know, that's the issue for me. What are our authorities doing? What is our American Civil Liberties Union doing? What are our defense attorneys who are making, you know, their life savings off of this whole thing? Not just the drug war, but, you know, I mean... And I'm not saying that they aren't doing a job that people wouldn't want them to do if they're suddenly finding themselves in circumstances where they're under criminal prosecution. But the whole thing is perverse and twisted as far as I'm concerned. And I think one has to see the whole picture in order to rectify it. By the way, you can call in at 427-3772. We're talking to Bernard Pregerson, a local attorney who has been here since 1975. You own your own home, by any chance, before Proposition 13 or...
Before Proposition 13,
that was a law that froze taxes at that time, and it was easier to, you know, if you own property.
Are you asking me what I think of Proposition
13? No, I was asking you I was saying you've been around for a long time. It'd be nice if you were able to buy your home before. It's completely irrelevant to what we're talking about. If you want to talk to Bernard,
let me answer your question. But anyway, you were about saying something.
427-3772 is the number to call in and talk to us. And I saw somebody did call in a moment ago, and don't give up. I mean,
call back.
Yeah, I mean, when you see that flashing, in fact,
take it.
We'll take it, and Bernard will comment in a moment on what he's thinking. You're on Free Radio with Bernard and Robert. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to discuss the health aspect of drug abuse.
Okay.
As opposed to the, what do you call it, illegality, the use aspect.
The kidnapping, extortion, removal of children from their home, loss of property aspect. That
certainly there are health issues involved with abuse. Sure. It's interesting that these issues we're so far away from dealing with, the reality of drugs and the human condition. It's like it's
they're not far from my mind. I just haven't gotten the chance to get to them yet. And they're actually a focus of what goes on in Judge Kelly's court, which is the main court that deals with personal use by adults of all drugs other than marijuana.
And what happens with, let's say, for example, possession of LSD?
You know, there's not that many cases, but if there was, it's a case that the first time around would get what's called drug diversion. If the person is guilty and there aren't any illegal police practices, the person pleads guilty, but their guilty plea is put in the deep freeze. It's not even entered in the record.
They're guilty of what? Possession?
Possession of LSD.
So they're
which
guilty
is an
of
illegal
a,
drug.
Controlled substance.
A controlled substance. How far are we away from dealing with the issue of controlled substances
You mean medically?
As law.
What, right? Changing the law, you mean?
Absolutely.
So that wouldn't
at some point, are we not going to address the reality of these things exist and they're not going to go away? I mean, I know this is kind of a naive way to put it, but the idea of being charged for possession, and as I said, there are health issues. People abuse things. They can abuse meth, what have you, and they need intervention. But it should be health intervention and not incarceration intervention.
There isn't much incarceration until someone
relapses for the fourth time. If they do a drug diversion and they get busted again, if they get busted a second time, they're doing time.
No, well, let me explain to you what happens to them. They get arrested. They may get released. If they don't get released, they have a chance to bail out. If they don't bail out, they have to be brought to court within 2 court days. So if you're arrested on a Monday, you get there on a Wednesday. Okay. If you're guilty, well, first of all, forget whether you're guilty or not. You can request to get released. Truthfully, the people who get released the easiest are the people who have ties to this community, which means family or a job, but not necessarily. There's a lot of people who live at the shelter who get released. But separate from that, you want to get released right away, and you have a chance to get released within 2 court days after your arrest.
Is this the first arrest or the second we're talking about?
Both.
Both.
Right.
When are blood tests or drug tests required?
At the time of your arrest.
Once you're arrested, you're harassed for essentially the rest of your life.
No, that's not true.
If you're busted the second time, do you get the same diversion?
No, I can explain to you what happens. First of all, if eventually you plead guilty, okay, you are definitely going to be released by then, unless you have other cases or you have a history of failures to appear on other cases, which 98% of the people don't have, so you get released. And you are given an appointment to meet with people trained to do drug assessments, and they are going to direct you after interviewing you for an hour and a half or 2 hours to an outpatient drug program. You come back to court for the first month or two every week to show the judge that you've started that program and are participating, and that you are also doing one other thing, which some people disagree with strongly, that you are participating in the 12-step program, meaning
you as a lawyer, you're a defense lawyer?
I am.
Okay, now what do you think of this? This is Big Brother.
I have a problem with the requirement.
Goose stuff. First of all, it says that one has to admit that one is guilty of a crime because they possess a certain substance. And in order to be relatively free, you got to agree to this goose step outpatient drug program and some kind of a 12-step program. Now, when, if ever, this is 2006, when, if ever, do people like yourselves address above board the reality that these substances can be used
by
mature adults without government intervention?
He's addressing it right now. Go ahead, Bernard.
Should we, as a country, and beyond the United States, like a few countries have in the world, legalize heavy drugs? And the answer is, at a minimum, we should look at it seriously and see how we can do it without spending all this time and money on this system that is draining the community's resources.
So essentially, you try to do the best you can given the circumstances.
Well, the laws aren't changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting how far above the radar this is. You know, they found this tunnel between Mexico and the States maybe a couple of weeks ago, 40 feet deep, and they were running marijuana. right? They found, I think, 300 pounds at one end and 200 at the other. And when Dianne Feinstein talks about this issue, doesn't even mention, well, let's look at drug reform.
And Barbara Boxer as well. Listen, let me move on, Bob, because I think we all agree on this.
Well,
they can't get it through, man. Let me tell you, the Court of Appeal in San Francisco voted in favor of the California taxpayers' law to legalize medical marijuana. But unfortunately, it got appealed by the U.S. attorney to the Supreme Court, and they reversed that. And we're stuck with that Supreme Court, and it's even worse now that Bush has gotten two people on the court on this issue.
Of course, the issue is not really ultimately courts. It's what the community decides to do.
All the best, Bernard.
Hey, thank you.
Robert, thanks.
Thanks, Bob. I mean, to me, this brings me to the next question I have, and we haven't really covered some of the past questions, but we're kind of touching on them a bit.
Let's go back.
Okay, but I also want to, I mean, I'm trying to get some idea of to from a person who is knowledgeable, spends 5 days a week in drug court, in Kelly's drug court, Tom Kelly, Kangaroo Kelly, as I call him. Nice guy, but you never know which.
I call him Kangaroo Kelly.
I call him Kangaroo Kelly, not necessarily because it's a kangaroo court, although sometimes it is, but because I was saying he'll never know which way he's going to hop. This is in the old days when he did homeless cases. He ruled that it's okay to arrest people for sleeping at night because they can sleep during the day. That was his ruling, Mr. Constitution Tom Kelly. Nice guy. Don't get me wrong. We know each other, and, you know, we're friendly. And in fact, I think he now opposes the sleeping ban, but, of course, not on a judicial basis. None of these people have the balls to stand up to the local political establishment is the problem. Now, what about – my question is, how do we change this situation locally? I mean, you're going to say, well, the Supreme Court has ruled, and, you know, I got to wait for the, you know, state legislature to change the, you know, the state criminal law on the issue of drugs, and also the federal Congress or the FDA, not the FDA, the whatever the drug administration is that, you know, classifies controlled substances. No, this community could make changes and choices itself, and we have a jury system.
Regarding which drug?
Regarding all drugs.
Okay, well, it's not going to happen regarding all drugs.
Well, what I'm saying is that if we want to stop the war on drugs here, there are various ways we can go about it. I've thought about standing in front of the courthouse telling juries about the right to nullify and saying it takes one juror on any drug case to say, horseshit, I say not guilty, goodbye, on this issue. Can you talk about how judges locally respond to jury nullification in our courts on drug cases and whether that ever happens?
Well, not many, you know... 99.9% of the cases never go to jury trial.
So there is where we could take it. If we suggest that every single person accused of a drug crime demand a jury trial, that would stop things dead in the water, wouldn't it?
Definitely. There aren't enough courtrooms. There's not enough personnel to handle that.
Maybe that's the way to go. I'm looking for a way for the community to be able to respond at a local level to change this, not to wait for corrupt legislators influenced by bigoted right-wing mentalities to try to address this, but how we ourselves as
a community. Well, defendants would need to individually and together reorganize to tell their lawyers, if I'm going to be found guilty, I'm going to be found guilty, but I want it to be done by a jury. But most defendants don't want to take the time out of their life to deal with coming back to court and coming back to court and waiting for their case to go to jury trial.
And most public defenders and defense attorneys perhaps thinking that they're trying to do the best they can for their clients, advise them you'll get a better deal and a nicer response from the judge if you don't go to trial. And particularly because the laws favor the police in so many respects, or because the court, the DAs and the judges and the police work so closely together often. And although you can give me your opinion on that at some point, that's my feeling. You're as likely, you know, they want you to take a deal in advance to move things along so that they can proceed with more abuse.
They want to settle cases because
right.
There's so many cases that are constantly coming in.
Roll more people into jail. Roll more people into this. To me, this is sort of an obscene system similar to slavery. It's not the same thing, obviously. It's not like chattel slavery. But in another sense, it's a repeated abuse that happens institutionally day in and day out. It's not going to happen tomorrow. When you go to court tomorrow, you're going to see one case after another of people who shouldn't be there.
But what I'm going to see tomorrow is that...
Hang on, caller. We'll be with you in a moment.
Persons who are only using drugs are not going to be going to jail. They're going to be going to treatment. And then when they relapse, they still won't be going to jail, other than maybe for a short period of time. And then when they relapse again, still won't be going to jail for any length
of
time.
But there's a hell of a lot of people in jail anyway, right?
But not for recreational use of drugs, even hard drugs.
Well, that's the question I have for you. Well, I would like to see the stats on the jail. Hi there, caller. You're on the air with Bernard and Robert.
Hi. I wanted to get back to meth a little bit.
This is Madison again?
Yeah, we called like several times. I get out of my car after 5 17-hour days of garden shows, and I can't breathe because the meth has sucked the oxygen from my lungs, okay? We've got a block of historic Victorians.
Where do you live?
Maple. And I'm calling down there, and it took me two nights this happened. Finally, they send a cop, and I said to him, this is a methamphetamine. I said, it's not. Do you know what methamphetamine smells like? Because I certainly do. And he goes, no. I'm like, well, why did they send you? I go, do you know what an 8-ball is? You know what that smells like? Nope. I'm like, well, what good is this? You know, this block's about to blow. And I called the fire department, and I tried to get them to come down, and they didn't. And I personally said, can you tell me what's in methamphetamine? And they go, no, we can't tell you. I'm like,
so you know what you should do to get some
paper?
Action?
Yeah.
You should look in the phone book under Santa Cruz County in the government section in the front, and look under Sheriff's Department.
I know I've called.
And look under the Drug Enforcement and ask to speak to one of the lieutenants up there. And
do
that
and
take it from there.
Let me give you an insight. I did South Central during the Tukey period when the Fed was stealing the heroin, and then they laundered it through HUD, and that was what was happening in South Central. I was there, okay? And L.A. Times busted it. So wake up Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
And the other problem we have is the same as that Oklahoma bombing and the same as the big tower thing. Is we have several agencies all in the same room, and who's watching who? Nobody. There's no impetus. They're all in the same room.
Okay, well, Madison, you've gotten a suggestion for Bernard as to how to proceed. We're going to help everybody inform everybody else here.
Jerry Brown. He's called
this
down.
Is free radio.
And he, you know, it's separation of powers, too.
Yeah.
So,
hey, Madison, thank you. Any quick question before you go?
No, that's it. Just, you know, but just keep at it. I mean, I think you're right about the pot. It's like a waste of time. It would be far better to be prosecuting the rape and the meth on a much higher level.
Thanks.
And, you know, pay the victims. You know, the cops get paid when they get the drug money, but where's, you know, where's my payment
victim
for the
compensation
bomb and everything else? You
thanks,
know, I'd
Madison.
Like a check.
So you're claiming, Bernard, that there's that there aren't that many people in jail for possession, use, sales of...
No, you keep changing.
Okay,
that.
well, that's
personal use of drugs.
Well, I mean, then let's stop dicking it around, though. I mean, because if you want to buy a drink, you got to buy it from somebody, right? If you want to buy a drug,
catch those others with
scales,
larger quantities,
this is all part of the same bullshit.
Those people, after they're pled guilty, they're going to be spending time in jail.
Right.
They still have a right until they plead guilty, because they're innocent until proven guilty, to bail out and go back home. And some of them are actually released on their promise to appear at their next court appearance.
Yeah, but I mean, what's the point? The point here is massive. There are plenty of people who aren't able to bail out, and there are plenty of people. My question really is for you. And maybe you can find this out in the days ahead. What are the stats? What percentage of the people are in jail in Santa Cruz County for drug sales, use, or possession, independent of other violent behavior? In other words, I'd like to see...
I wouldn't be able to find out, but I bet the lieutenant would assist you over at the jail on Water Street. But do you want to know about the people who are in the jail before their cases are over? Because those people are on the Water Street jail. The only other people in the Water Street jail are people who are parole violators or people who are already sentenced and have gone to our two jails in Watsonville but have had escapes or behavior problems. There's also the people who are sentenced and doing their time either at the rehab or the Roundtree facility in Watsonville.
Right.
And I think you'd want to know how many of those people were there for drug-related
sure.
stuff?
Sure. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, I'm asking you not because I'm looking for the most accurate figure in the world, but I'm looking for a ballpark figure of what percentage of the jail population is being jailed under the local drug war? I mean, that's really the question. I mean, I see the ACLU locally. It has its drug policy unit here. I don't know if you've ever been to it. It's down on 1010.
Yeah, I've been to it. They came and spoke to the defense bar here.
Huh. They're right above Taqueria Vallarta on Pacific Avenue. Nice people, although they're a little paranoid about when you go in and wander around their building. But they have many offices, a staff of, 10 or 15, 20 people, some attorneys there, and they cover the scene nationally. But they have absolutely no interest in the local drug war. And I want to see those of us who are concerned about the local drug war know where to go to begin the political organizing to stop it here. See, that because I think that if we start to do that here, other communities can do likewise. And then the legislators will run to catch up with us. Because
I think one of the problems that's happening in Santa Cruz is, for most people, it's not a high priority because as far as this community is concerned, things are handled with such a heavy hand in this community.
Aren't handled.
Are not.
Right. Well, I think most people are unaware of it until they face it in their own lives. That's my feeling. I think most people, it's just the idea of the other, although the drug person is not part of my group. You know, it's not my problem. It's not people I know. It's not my son, my daughter, my father. It's, those people downtown who are homeless or, the people in the cop shows or something like that. If we have a sense of the actual numbers of people really involved in this whole process, and that's what I called you into the studio to find out, Mr. Drug Court Man, then perhaps we can get a closer look at this. Now, you've been kind of, your line here has been, hey, you got to go to court at least 3 or 4 times before they're going to jail you.
For a significant period of time.
For personal use.
For a significant period of time.
Right, for a significant, well.
When you get arrested, you go to jail.
Right.
And if you have traffic warrants out, you may not get out for 2 days.
And you may find your tenancy is threatened by this kind of thing because the landlord may not like that. I mean, in a tight housing market, you may find your job is threatened at some point because of this. All kinds of consequences happen. So I don't think we should belittle the effects.
No, I don't
of
think
this.
So right. either. I think jobs are. I bring it up a lot in court,
right.
And it's and Judge Kelly. I think he's pretty good about paying attention to that. There's another call.
Hi, caller. You're on the air with Bernard Pregerson and Robert Norris. That's me.
Hi, it's Madison again. We found it more effective to clean out methamphetamine dealers. Use Section 8. It happens way faster than the police department.
Okay.
We could call for a year on them, and they didn't clean them out. And then Section 8ers, man, they're out there just like that. It's
thank
overnight.
You.
It's like, thank God. And, anybody who's got a meth problem and they're on Section 8, go for it.
Thanks, Madison. Madison's passionately, obviously, involved in this issue, as she is in a lot of issues. And I, frankly, I'm passionately involved in a lot of issues, too, so I'm sympathetic with that approach, much as I disagree with, I don't know. I'm not living on Elm Street or Maple Street or whatever it is. If a person wants to observe this process in action and see the fighting Bernard Pregerson defending the rights of clients and advising them to go to jury trial and fight back, as I'm sure you do with many clients, right?
Should have been there today at 3:45 when I fought to keep a guy out of state prison.
Okay, now in the sense that you encourage him to go to jury trial or you're doing
it wasn't a trial case. He was in violation of 2 prior probations and... He had pled guilty to misdemeanor under the influence. But he had a terrible record.
This is Tom Kelly's court. Which that's the jail court? Where is Kelly's court?
Department 11. If you walk into the jail at 259 Water Street.
And they won't hold you just for going to court.
Definitely not. You make a sharp right, and there's a small courtroom in the right corner of the building.
Sharp right, to say the least, in the courtroom of Tom Kelly.
You got it.
Yeah. Do they have a metal detector there yet, or you have to go through metal detector?
They have one. It's never been operational.
Yeah, I'm always concerned about the nuclear weapons that they're sneaking into the courtroom and, stripping down before going into court. So you're there pretty much on a daily basis.
Pretty much. Court starts at 8:30.
Right.
Primarily for people who are coming in to have their Prop 36 probations reviewed. And at 9:30 are people who've been arrested in the last 2 days for either new charges or probation violations. And then there's other people there at 9:30 for second and third court appearances.
So how many of the judges would you suspect actually use drugs themselves? This is the reason I mention this to you, and the to me the whole system is just riddled with hypocrisy. You have a situation where, you know, people. My prosecutor, Archie Weber, I'm being prosecuted for disrupting a public meeting in a case coming up on April 17th. For all you folks out there who want to come to my trial, it starts April 17th. He's also prosecuting a medical marijuana user, and he acknowledged that his brother uses marijuana, went off to Amsterdam. He didn't say he did, and he didn't say he violated the law. But one has the feeling that there's a lot of hypocrisy happening here, where people are themselves like, was it Catherine Gardner under the... the great revered Art Danner in 1995, there was a scandal about cocaine use in the prosecutor's office. I don't know if you remember that.
Sure.
There's a lot of this going on, and you know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's nobody's business what you do.
So your question is about the ethics of DAs and judges.
I'm just expressing my frustration, my. I'm looking. I mean, you're here to provide us with an education of what happens in drug court, and you're struggling mightily to do this because I'm throwing a lot of other stuff at you.
I've been in across the street and have handled previous to the last 3.5 years. I was up at juvenile court for 3 years, and was really shocked when I came back how many teenage meth users there were, because that's I think about 7 years ago. The epidemic really started. I've seen the devastation on my clients physically. Mm-hmm. And if they could get themselves to stop using methamphetamine without having to be dragged into the court system, and if there was an effective alternative to that.
What might that be? Let me take this caller quickly. This better not be Madison, or I'm making short work of you, Madison. Hi there, you're on free radio.
Yeah, my question is about...
Madison.
The state went down 12% in crime, and Santa Cruz went up 30%. So we got a 42% spread, and what does he think is causing that?
Okay, thank you. Answer to that question?
I wasn't paying attention. I thought there was a limit on calls, actually. Three.
This is
caller.
Free.
If you repeat it, I'll be glad to give it a shot.
Sure, he's saying that the state crime rate is down, but local crime rate is up. How do you...
I'd have to see the statistics. I don't know how. There's a way to manipulate statistics, and there's also could be totally accurate. But crime, which crimes are down? Right. Does that include trespass and petty theft?
But let's get back to this other question, because I think I hear what you're saying. Madison, we don't have the stats for that answer.
Okay.
What could be the alternatives? What have other countries, or what might, even if it hasn't happened elsewhere, what might be done in a visionary way as an alternative to the court system for people who are, meth users so they won't be abusers, or for, who are abusers so they can deal with their problems, other than, of course, the Roman Catholic Church, Scientology, and the 12-step program. I'm not trying to be, everybody has their own approach to this, but for the secularists among us.
Right. Well, let's just start with education for young people. And I mean young people. I'm talking about people in, before junior high, let's say starting with fifth grade, where someone comes in and more than one person and talks honestly about the realities of methamphetamine. Let's just pick methamphetamine.
Okay.
How you take it, what it does to your body over long-term and short-term use. So you got education.
Okay.
And then the question is, who's going to do the educating? Parents? What if there's no parent? What if it's the father split? And it's now a teenage boy who's really not paying much attention to his mother because he's severing his emotional ties to her like a lot of boys do. So who's going to educate that 14-year-old boy about important things in life, including methamphetamine use?
But is that where the problem comes from? I mean, are you?
No, it's not. Lack of education isn't the only place.
I mean, I guess I'm looking for some kind of radical or even unradical idea, non-radical idea about places where people could go to address these issues in some other way than wait for. Tom Kelly's drug court, you know. I mean, are you familiar? I mean, have you attended any conferences on this issue, or have you read much about it nationally? We're expecting you to do some research.
I've read a really good book by a doctor who runs a really successful inpatient treatment program in Los Angeles. But you see, that costs money. There's very few inpatient treatment programs, period, and the people who have good health insurance can go to those. But you know what the statistics are about the Betty Ford program and other expensive programs? What really matters is what kind of support system and what your actions are when you leave the program. Mm-hmm. Are you going to go back with your drug-using friends and community, or are you going to move into a different social community?
Caller, you're on free radio. Go ahead.
His topic on kids.
Ah!
428 kids suspended last year. I think
okay.
that's an extremely high number, and it had to do with assault, which is probably meth-related. I know a lady who wants to do that program for the kids. She was busted. She did state time. She was with Clinton's brother.
Madison, I'm going to roll with it, but, I mean, thank you for the information. And,
okay, I know. Well, I mean, I think we should sue the schools and say, look, parents, you got to be responsible. 420 kids suspended?
Thanks.
Suspended for drug use? Is that what she was referring to?
She might have been referring to that or to assault. I'm again, that's
weapons, carrying a knife on campus, fighting. But a lot of those suspensions are for bringing, you know, marijuana on campus.
So...
or other drugs.
I guess I'm trying to get a purchase. I mean, it sounds like this hysteria against, you know, against drugs, although not against prescription drugs, which are massively overprescribed, is, you know, infiltrated every level of both the education system, the criminal system, and the question is where do you begin begin to root it out? And the answer is wherever you happen to be, maybe.
Well, here's a more of a widespread answer, which is. Human beings, probably from the beginning of time, but I would say more now, and that's Western society we have in America with a lot of difficulties, but we're not the only country that has a lot of difficulties. People do things to anesthetize themselves, make themselves feel good, even if it's a short-term basis, which drugs are. And so... what's the solution for one human being to find balance and peace of mind without using something externally to make them feel better? Well, that's kind of a question about how do you find, quote-unquote, spiritual fulfillment without the use of drugs, sex, workaholism, alcohol, television, and that's a big question and a difficult one. Probably one everyone struggles with, including you and me, on our own levels on a day-to-day or weekly basis.
Of course, the problem is, should we have to also struggle with law authorities breathing down our necks, heavily funded by different government agencies, going after essentially the wrong things? And
the answer to some of that is no, and then the answer to, well, why is that happening, Bernard? Is one of the answers is politics. There's certain people in power, and they've decided what's right, what's wrong, but not so much what's right and what's wrong. The things that we're going to label wrong or illegal, how hard we're going to spank someone on the back of the hand.
I think it's more than just people in power making decisions. I think there's an institutional inertia here, which kind of gathers force. I mean... it's amazing to me that, you know, marijuana is still criminalized after 5 decades and after it's been shown repeatedly to be not only harmless but actually beneficial. And so it seems to me that you have some kind of, obviously there are institutional interests or there's some fundamental irrational force here. And our question here is maybe not so much analysis as to find some way to engage in action to combat this.
Well, I thought the voters passed the initiative. The government came in and did a big bust. Went over to federal district court. Got reversed in the court of appeal favorably. And with the help of a Santa Cruz lawyer, Ben Rice, and Dean Ullman.
Talk about the Corral case.
Right, yeah. Right. But, you know, when push came to shove, we found out who's in power here, and it's not people that think like you and me.
Well, I don't think the feds, frankly, they're the villains, obviously, in some respects, but the real villains to me are the people who keep the system going locally. It wouldn't work. The feds couldn't do shit if attorneys didn't go to court every day, if judges didn't keep turning down these decisions, if jailers didn't keep locking people up. If they didn't make those individual decisions, it would stop, just as the war in Iraq would be stopping if we found some way to do that.
If Hillary Clinton and other Democrats wouldn't have kind of thrown the towel in and voted for going to war.
And in fact, are pounding their breasts for more troops, for that matter.
Right.
Look at it that way.
Right. So, you know, what's that all about?
Well, but it's over
a much more serious issue.
We don't have to wait for Hillary Clinton and these other big-name politicians. It's the local scene that goes on here.
It's the same local process.
I don't think we wait for the Supreme. It's like Rotkin saying, we won't have an Office of Compassionate Use.
No, I'm not saying wait.
Right. I mean, he's saying there's no Office of Compassionate Use until the Supreme Court rules it's going to be okay, which is preposterous. The Supreme Court is not going to rule an Office of Compassionate Use is okay. We have to set up an Office of Compassionate Use, and if they want to fuck with us, then they'll fuck with us.
But they did, and we'll do again, maybe.
Well, they have, you know, but they have to do it selectively. They have to be careful. They raided this station once. But, you know, we've been going for a year and a half since then. We're afraid. They've been talking to people in Berkeley. They may come after us again. You know, but the fact is, we keep going. What's happening instead, however, and the drug war scene is the opposite is happening. We're going, what's happening is the drug war, the evil that is the drug war, the war against people using drugs, continues every day. People go to work every day, like you do, and continue to essentially serve a function in that system, which ultimately destroys lives. Not just you, but you're a part of a machine that is daily destroying lives. See,
well, what is the destruction of lives? Yeah.
How do we stop this?
The destruction of lives?
The criminalization and penalization of people, you know, who are accused of using drugs and who are dragged into court for that purpose.
How are their lives destroyed?
They're put in jail. Their property is seized.
Significant consequences.
Right,
that
right.
With their
yes, significant okay. consequences.
When you said destroy life, I got it.
So, we're at the end of our time. It's 8 o'clock. Probably the next person's coming in. You've only agreed to be here for an hour. If at any time you want to come back with an update
sure.
or, you know, to continue more.
Or I'll sit here until they come. Either way.
No, you're welcome to stay, but Dennis will probably be here momentarily.
That'll be fine. I'll be walking out the door.
Have you got any drugs we can share? I mean, we can do a little civil disobedience.
I got my chewing gum you gave me. This is right now. This is a
you got weird drugs in the chewing gum. That's
drug because it's still got its flavor. What kind is it?
It is. What the heck is it? It's that sugarless gum. Looks like we may have had a caller.
Something my sister chews. Here he comes.
Looks like I'm afraid that it's time for music to replace.
Right on time.
Hey, man, you are right on time. Dennis is here with some musical sounds. Bernard, thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. Hey,
good luck in your trial.
Hey, I expect, you know, maybe I'll come on drugs.
April what?
April 17th.
Okay.
All right, man. Thank you, Bernard. So that's it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides for tonight. I will be coming back at the early hour of 7:30 in the morning on Sunday. I don't know about that. But you're going to get to hear the entire downtown commission discussion of 10 minutes in the parking lot and then go to jail. So it's going to be fun till your daddy takes the T-Bird away. Because if you haven't got no T-Bird, you can't go into the parking garage, right? Yeah, so I guess you can get a bike. Or maybe go to the bathroom. Anyway, join me then. Call me between times if you've got some comments to make. 423-4833 is my number off air. Huff website again has shows up. If you missed this or earlier shows, you can find those shows archived at huffsantacruz.org. Thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm going to keep babbling until Dennis puts in a CD here. He's always equipped with at least 500 CDs.
Or more.
Maybe I should put in a CD. Save Dennis.
Should put in a CD about 2 minutes before 8, Robert.
No, for heaven's sake. I mean, let's not grumble here, Dennis.
Talking about proper radio etiquette,
yeah,
Robert.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Dennis is, he's been professional. I'm just an amateur in this job. So here's a little Danielle Savage. I'm going out. Dennis is coming in. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
titles to songs aren't really important, but it's a way to identify. It don't matter what you do.